Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta te sangamata sadvara yesu tovanto pamanchantu sadhati. I don't know if you heard the one about the two monks sitting together in a cave. One of them said nothing. The other one said, I was just going to say that. My old teacher, Lumpur Hom, who's now passed away, and he used to start off every Dhamma talk by saying, today is a very special day in Buddhism. Without fail, every Dhamma talk. No matter what the occasion was, he would always start out with the same words. And it's a very good way to start it, because, see, I can still remember it after all these years. And anyway, it's true, but today's special day is of course, the Upasatha day. And it just so happens that our little talk for this evening falls on the Upasatha. And so maybe I'll talk a little bit about this, take the opportunity to talk about the practice of Upasatha, what significance it has. Basically, the word Upasatha, I believe, Upasatha, I think it's the root of it, means to dwell near. Don't quote me on that. I'm not 100% sure of the etymology. I think it means to dwell near, upavasata. It's a bit like the meaning they have. This word upa is used in a similar sense for, we're familiar with the terms, or maybe familiar with the terms ubasaka, ubasika, the lay woman followers and lay man followers. And the word upa has the same meaning, like drawing near. And also in the Brahmanical scriptures, the Upanishads, like the Upanishad is actually Upanishidati, from the root Upanishidati, to sit near. It's exactly the same root as Upasika. Upasika is actually Upasika, to sit near. And exactly the same derivation. There's two roots meaning to sit in Pali or Sanskrit, but actually the meaning is exactly the same, to sit near. So Upavasata, to dwell near. And Upa also, like that meaning, and like upasampada is the same kind of thing, like to enter into or within, come close to or within a community. So this idea of upasata, like to enter into the monastery or dwell near the Dhamma or however you want to take it, this is the basic meaning of it. And of course is like many religious festivals or religious days all around the world is timed to the lunar cycle, and rather than to the solar cycle, which governs the years, the religious festivals tend to be aligned with the lunar cycles. And so this gives like a regular pattern to one's life. And throughout various divergent religious traditions, you know, it is remarkable how we find similar kinds of ideas, like this idea, for example, of having a holy day once a week. And of course, you know, the word we say holiday, of course, is one of these worn out metaphors, you know, worn out words, which has become so depreciated with usage that we forget what it means. But of course, holiday is, of course, a holy day. What else would it be? And so this is like a special day which is set aside in the week. And so this is one of the meanings of holiness, is something which is separated. Okay, so a holy day is something which is separated, distinguished, set apart from, and so creates a sense of it's almost like insulated. Something which is holy is almost insulated from daily life. And so you were creating a special place where only holy things take place. So we do that in time. We also, we do, like, just like we do that in space. we create a place like the cave or like a shrine room. Like a shrine room where only the sacred activities take place. We don't do profane activities in the shrine room. We only do meditation, Dhamma talks, and chanting. In our special cave is even more so. We only keep it just very, very distinct, only for holy things. We don't do profane acts there. And so this is one of the qualities that makes a sacred space. We set it aside, we separate it. And so it seems that people in widely varying cultures and across many different parts of the world felt this need or the benefit of creating once a week a holy day. And of course, we're familiar, of course, we have our weekends, and originally the holy day for the Hebrew people was the Saturday, and this was set aside as the Sabbath by God. Later on, the Pope decided to change it from Saturday to Sunday, thus proving he knows more about it than God does. But in any case, and it's interesting that idea of the Sabbath, at least in its form that it comes now, the Bible scholars believe that this custom of having the seventh day as a holy day is justified by the origin myth in Genesis, where it says, you know, the God created the heaven and the earth and so on in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. And the scholars now believe that particular narrative was composed while the Hebrew people were imprisoned in Babylon, and they'd been captured by the Babylonians, I think it was about 700 or something BC, and taken off for slavery for a good long period of time. And while they were there, they concocted this little myth, and they sold that to their Babylonian rulers, and they said, okay, this myth tells us that we can't do any kind of work on the Sabbath, on the seventh day, and if we do, we have to be killed. And so we can't transgress this at all. And so they managed to fob this one off on their Babylonian rulers, who perhaps had a little bit of common sense and were able to realize that it wasn't such a bad thing to let their workers rest for one day a week. And so this was like the first piece of industrial relations legislation. And it's still in force today, isn't it? It's so successful. John Howard can't even keep his industrial relations legislation going for a few years without having it changed, whereas the Hebrew one has still been going for 2,500 years and is still very good. We still have regulations against kind of, you know, working on the weekends and these kinds of things. So we've got a lot to be thankful for. And so of course the 7 day, the fact that it's in 7 days, of course, is originally derived, or would have originally been related to the lunar cycles, seven being the quarter of the cycle of the moon, but of course the lunar cycle not being exactly divided into days, so it gets out of sync. So they adopted the convention to keep it just 7 days regardless of where the moon is at, but the origin of it would have been the lunar cycle. In the Indic tradition, has kept the lunar cycle. So while we still keep a special day once every 7 or 8 days, but this is not doesn't sync up with the days of the week. So how they usually work it is that the month starts on the full moon. And then you have a period of usually 8 days, sometimes 7 or 8 days to the. I think it's always 8 days the way they count it, to the quarter of the moon, the half moon, which is a quarter of a month. And this is kind of observed as, I mean, in Thailand they call the one pranoy, is a smaller holy day, and that's not a Uposatha according to the Vinaya, but it's still observed as a special day. And then the black moon, or the new moon, is the other Uposatha, and then the half moon again is another special day, but not considered to be formally an Uposatha. So the actual Uposatha itself, as far as the Vinaya is concerned, happens on the new moon and the black moon. Of course, the exact time that the moon is full is not obvious, and there are different ways of working it out. So you'll find in the different Buddhist traditions it might vary by one day, occasionally by 2 days, as to which day the exact Uposatha is. And so this, of course, was a tradition which was observed for a very long, long time before the Buddha came along. And I'm sure if you were going to dig into the history, there would be a very kind of long and convoluted history behind these things. And one of the kind of the great sort of natural reasons for it is because, especially on that full moon day, full moon night, there is a very special energy about the full moon night. And I'm sure we've all experienced that. We've all experienced that when it is the full moon and sometimes you can't get to sleep, like you want to get to sleep, but you can't. Just the energy is so there's such a buzz in the air. And of course, it's just the brightness of it. And for us, it may be not so special, but if you're living in countries before electricity, in times before electricity was available, then that brightness of the full moon night is very, very special. And so, of course, it's the natural time to be having religious festivals of any kind, whether they be like fertility festivals and sort of running riot over the hills with all the lads and lasses making merry, or whether it be sacrifices, or whether it be kind of Vedic rituals with intoning the mantras and so on, or whatever it may be. And all of these things tend to get timed very often on the full moon. And the Buddha, as we've read in some of the suttas earlier, used to regard the full moon nights as specially auspicious, and would go out and sometimes sit meditation all night in the awe-inspiring jungle groves. And just to test himself, he would go and sit there and see what would happen on those nights, because there's something special in the energy there. I remember one night when I was in Ipoh and staying in the cave there, and this night full moon was so bright. I later found out that it, for some special reason, it was the brightest full moon that there'd been for a long time. But it was just so much energy in the air, I just couldn't sleep at all. And I went for alms round in the next morning. And one of the regular supporters came up to offer dana on the alms round, and she said, "Oh, I couldn't sleep last night." She couldn't sleep either. And it was just so much energy in the air that night. And so there is something to this. And so these days, of course, very, marked down as being very special. Now, because, there's a combination of a kind of a mystical or spiritual side to this, but also a very pragmatic side to it, because in the Indic culture it was the custom to be doing religious festivals and so on these days, and so there would of course be the tendency for more people to visit the monastery on those days, and so this would in the wanderers of other sects, the other kinds of religions that were around at the time of the Buddha, the people would tend to visit the monastery on the Uposatha day. Just like people in a Christian culture would visit the church on a Sunday. Maybe they don't think about church the rest of the week, but on a Sunday they sort of go along and spend an hour or two in the church. And the same thing in Buddhist cultures or Indic cultures, they'll go along to the temple or something, maybe offer some dana. They might do some other activities while they're there, maybe do some chanting or listen to some dhamma or something, and then go back home. And so when this happened, the lay people sometimes would visit the monasteries, the Buddhist monasteries in the early days, and they would visit, and because they were used to getting some teaching or something like that from the summoners and the wanderers, and but they went to the monasteries, and this custom hadn't been established yet, so the monks didn't really know what to do. And so it says in the Vinaya, when it talks about this, it said the monks sat there like dumb pigs. The lay people complained about it. How can these monks sit there like dumb pigs? And interestingly enough, the Buddha never criticized the lay people for calling the monks dumb pigs. He said, "Okay, monks, don't sit there like dumb pigs. Give the dhamma talk." And it is something to be worth noting about. We've talked about this before, that that these days there seem to be an ethic that there's something inherently wrong or evil about criticizing monks and nuns for anything. And this is certainly not the case. And according to the Buddha, if there was a valid criticism, then of course, you know, that's okay. Of course, you shouldn't be needlessly criticizing or maliciously criticizing. But if there's something that needs to be criticized about, then that's all right. The Buddha would never criticize the criticizer. He would always ask, is it true? And if it was true, he would reprimand the person who'd done something wrong. If not, then never mind. So in this case, the lay people were criticizing the monks. Okay, you're sitting around like dumb pigs. And so they said, okay, you can give some Dhamma talk. So this was kind of the origin of the Uposatha festival for the involvement of the lay people. Now, as well as that, of course, there was also the monastic ceremony, which developed for the same day. And this started out as a reciting of the Parimokkha. So the Buddha allowed the reciting of the Parimokkha on the Uposatha day. Now, it's not sure exactly what he meant or what is meant by the text originally when it said that the Parimokkha was to be recited. In fact, originally the Buddha himself recited the Parimokkha. Now, it's not quite sure what's meant by that, and most people, I think the position of the tradition, and I think probably shared by most scholars, was that what was recited is what is known, the verses that are known today as the Ovada Parimokkha, the Parimokkha for exhortation. And these, of course, the verses beginning with Sabbapapasa karanam kusala supasampada sacitta pariyodarpanang etam buddhana sasanam. Not doing any evil to cultivate the skillful and purify the mind. This is the dispensation of the Buddhas. And so these very famous verses were possibly regarded as a summary of the Buddha's teaching. And these possibly constituted the earliest Parimokkha. Certainly, in all of the existing Parimokkhas that we have, with the exception of the Theravadin or the Pali Parimokkha, which we recite, every other version that we have of the Parimokkha, whether in Chinese, Tibetan or Sanskrit, they all feature these verses at the end. And so it certainly was a universal tradition among the schools that they would recite these verses on the Uposatha day. And for some strange reason, the Theravadin tradition has stopped this custom. We do recite some verses, but not the same ones. We recite some other ones. So, originally, probably just reciting the Ovada Parimokkha, and the story was that on one occasion the monks were sitting around on the Uposatha day, and the Buddha was going to recite the Parimokkha, and they sat for the first watch of the night. That means from about 6 o'clock through to about 10 o'clock. And then Venerable Ananda and the Buddha just sat there silent. And Venerable Ananda got up and said, Venerable Sir, he said to the Buddha, the Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Buddha would teach the Parimokkha out of compassion. And then the Buddha sat there saying nothing. And then the monk sat there through the middle watch of the night until 2 o'clock in the morning. Ananda gets up and says, Venerable Sir, the Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Blessed One would teach the Parimokkha out of compassion. And the Buddha said nothing. And then they sat through until they could just see the rosy flush of dawn appearing on the face of the sky. And Venerable Ananda stands up and says, Blessed One, the Bhikkhu Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Blessed One would teach the Parimokkha out of compassion. A very remarkable restraint that the monks were displaying here, 4 hours at a time. And the Buddha said, Ananda, the Tathagata, does not teach the Parimokkha to an impure assembly. At which time this kind of feeling of dread goes through the Sangha. And I think it was Venerable Moggallana then thought, what's this? What's the Buddha referring to? And then he used his mind and read the minds of all the monks there. And he saw that there was one monk there who was of evil wishes, a corrupt and decadent monk, no pure monk, even though he was pretending to be, no liver of the holy life, even though he was pretending to be corrupt and rotten through to the core. And so he said to the monk, "Venerable sir, you must leave the assembly." Three times he said it, the monk sat there and didn't move. Finally, and I think it was Moggallana, had to get up, take him by the arm, and physically throw him out of the Sangha. And which is a kind of interesting anecdote from a number of points of view. One thing it shows you is that even monks or nuns who have very good psychic powers and can read minds, they're not necessarily doing it all the time. But sometimes we're worried. We think, oh, that someone's going to be reading our minds all the time, and so-and-so's got psychic powers, therefore they know everything about us. Well, it's not necessarily the case. And in fact, that's what the monks and nuns who I know of who have psychic powers, this is what they say, is that they don't go rummaging around in the garbage of other people's minds all the time. If you've gone to all that effort to purify your own mind, would you want to be going back into the pigsty? Well, no, not really, not unless you really had to. So anyway, and after this the Buddha said, it's impossible, it cannot happen, that the Tathagata should give a vada. In an impure assembly, and after that he made the allowance for the bhikkhus to do it themselves. And he taught a sutta at that time which has the eight wonderful and marvelous qualities of the great ocean, among of which the eight qualities were that the great ocean shelves, slopes and inclines gradually with no sudden steep precipice. And in the same way that the training and practice in the Dhamma Vinaya of the Buddha is gradual and inclines gradually towards Nibbana with no sudden penetration through to final knowledge. And this is quite an interesting little statement here, because this the question of sudden or gradual practice was one of the great controversies in later forms of Buddhism, known as the Ekabhisamaya Vada. And also in both in Indian Buddhism and also in later Chan Buddhism, was one of the defining controversies in China. So this was one of the eight great qualities of the ocean and many others. And then one of the qualities was that just as the great ocean does not tolerate a corpse, but when there's a corpse which dies in the ocean, it will wash it up and will reject it upon the shore, in the same way that the Sangha does not tolerate corrupt bhikkhus or corrupt bhikkhunis, but will expel them and kick them out. And so quite a strong statement there by the Buddha on the nature, on what he thought of corrupt people who are living the holy life, but not pretending to live the holy life without really doing so sincerely. So after this point on, then the Sangha was authorized to perform its own uposatha, and perhaps it was at this point that the uposatha changed from being simply the recitation of a few communal verses to being like the formal declaration of the rules of training. And so at some point this change was made, and the custom on the uposatha came to be that the Sangha would come together, the Bhikkhu Sangha would come together as one, the Bhikkhuni Sangha would come together as one, and they would recite their rules of training which they had been laid down, that is what we know today as the Patimokkha. So of course this being in the Theravadin recension for the Bhikkhus, the 227 rules for Bhikkhus, the 311 rules for Bhikkhunis, and this custom continues up until today. This is a very beautiful ceremony. I mean, of course, in the Buddha's time, it had a very practical educational purpose. Of course, everybody knew the language very, and so every couple of weeks, there's a combination of a kind of a mystical or spiritual side to this, but also a very pragmatic side to it. Because in the Indic culture it was the custom to be doing religious festivals and so on these days. And so there would of course be the tendency for more people to visit the monastery on those days. And so this would, in the wanderers of other sects, the other kinds of religions that were around at the time of the Buddha, the people would tend to visit the monastery on the uposatha day. Just like people in a Christian culture would visit the church on a Sunday, and maybe they don't think about church the rest of the week, then on a Sunday they sort of go along and spend an hour or two in the church. And the same thing in Buddhist cultures or Indic cultures, they'll go along to the temple or something, maybe offer some dana. They might do some other activities while they're there, maybe do some chanting or listen to some dhamma or something, and then go back home. And so when this happened, the lay people sometimes would visit the monasteries, the Buddhist monasteries in the early days, and they would visit, and because they were used to getting some teaching or something like that from the summoners and the wanderers, but they went to the monasteries, and this custom hadn't been established yet, so the monks didn't really know what to do. And so it says in the Vinaya, when it talks about this, it said the monks sat there like dumb pigs. The lay people complained about it. How can these monks sit there like dumb pigs? And interestingly enough, the Buddha never criticized the lay people for calling the monks dumb pigs. He said, okay, monks, don't sit there like dumb pigs, give the Dhamma talk. And it is something to be worth noting about. We've talked about this before, that these days there seem to be an ethic that there's something inherently wrong or evil about criticizing monks and nuns for anything. And this is certainly not the case. And according to the Buddha, if there was a valid criticism, then of course, you know, that's okay. Of course, you shouldn't be needlessly criticizing or maliciously criticizing, but if there's something that needs to be criticized about, then that's all right. The Buddha would never criticize the criticizer. He would always ask, is it true? And if it was true, he would reprimand the person who'd done something wrong. If not, then never mind. So in this case, the lay people were criticizing the monks. Okay, you're sitting around like dumb pigs. And so they said, okay, you can give some Dhamma talk. So this was kind of the origin of the Uposatha festival for the involvement of the lay people. Now, as well as that, of course, there was also the monastic ceremony, which developed for the same day. And this started out as a reciting of the Parimokkha. So the Buddha allowed the reciting of the Parimokkha on the Uposatha day. Now, it's not sure exactly what he meant or what is meant by the text originally when it said that the Parimokkha was to be recited. In fact, originally the Buddha himself recited the Parimokkha. Now, it's not quite sure what's meant by that, and most people, I think the position of the tradition, and I think probably shared by most scholars, was that what was recited is what is known, the verses that are known today as the Ovada Parimokkha, the Parimokkha for exhortation. And these of course, the verses beginning with Sabbapapasa karanam kusala supasampada sacitta pariyoda panang etang buddhana sasanang. They're not doing any evil to cultivate the skillful and purify the mind. This is the dispensation of the Buddhas. And so these very famous verses were possibly regarded as a summary of the Buddha's teaching, and these possibly constituted the earliest Parimokkha. Certainly, in all of the existing Parimokkhas that we have, with the exception of the Theravadin or the Pali Parimokkha, which we recite, every other version that we have of the Parimokkha, whether in Chinese, Tibetan or Sanskrit, they all feature these verses at the end. And so it certainly was a universal tradition among the schools that they would recite these verses on the Uposatha day. And for some strange reason, the Theravadin tradition has stopped this custom. We do recite some verses, but not the same ones. We recite some other ones. So originally, probably just reciting the Ovada Parimokkha, and there's the story was that on one occasion the monks were sitting around on the Uposatha day, and the Buddha was going to recite the Parimokkha, and they sat for the first watch of the night. That means from about 6 o'clock through to about 10 o'clock, and then Venerable Ananda and the Buddha just sat there silent, and Venerable Ananda got up and said, Venerable Sir, he said to the Buddha, the Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Buddha would teach the Parimokkha out of compassion. And then the Buddha sat there saying nothing. And then the monk sat there through the middle watch of the night until 2 o'clock in the morning. Ananda gets up and says, Venerable Sir, the Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Blessed One would teach the Patimokkha out of compassion. And the Buddha said nothing. And then they sat through until they could just see the rosy flush of dawn appearing on the face of the sky. And Venerable Ananda stands up and says, Blessed One, the Bhikkhu Sangha has been sitting for a long time. It would be good if the Blessed One would teach the Patimokkha out of compassion. A very remarkable restraint that the monks were displaying here, 4 hours at a time. And the Buddha said, Ananda, the Tathagata, does not teach the Patimokkha to an impure assembly. At which time this kind of feeling of dread goes through the Sangha. And I think it was Venerable Moggallana then thought, what's the Buddha referring to? And then he used his mind and read the minds of all the monks there. And he saw that there was one monk there who was of evil wishes, a corrupt and decadent monk, no pure monk, even though he was pretending to be, no liver of the holy life, even though he was pretending to be corrupt and rotten through to the core. And so he said to the monk, Venerable Sir, you must leave the assembly. 3 times, he said it, the monk sat there and didn't move. Finally, and I think it was Moggallana, had to get up, take him by the arm, and physically throw him out of the Sangha. And which is a kind of interesting anecdote from a number of points of view. One thing it shows you is that even people, even monks or nuns who have very good psychic powers and can read minds, they're not necessarily doing it all the time. Sometimes we're worried, we think, that someone's going to be reading our minds all the time, and so-and-so's got psychic powers, therefore they know everything about us. Well, it's not necessarily the case. And in fact, that's what the monks and nuns who I know of who have psychic powers, this is what they say, is that they don't go rummaging around in the garbage of other people's minds all the time. If you've gone to all that effort to purify your own mind, would you want to be going back into the pigsty? Well, no, not really, not unless you really had to. So anyway, and after this the Buddha said, it's impossible, it cannot happen that the Tathagata should give a vada in an impure assembly. And after that he made the allowance for the bhikkhus to do it themselves. And he taught a sutta at that time which has the 8 wonderful and marvelous qualities of the great ocean, among of which the 8 qualities were that the great ocean shelves, slopes and inclines gradually with no sudden steep precipice. And in the same way that the training and practice in the Dhamma Vinaya of the Buddha is gradual and inclines gradually towards Nibbana with no sudden penetration through to final knowledge. And this is quite an interesting little statement here, because the question of sudden or gradual practice was one of the great controversies in later forms of Buddhism, known as the Ekabhisamaya-vada. And also in Indian Buddhism and also in later Chan Buddhism was one of the defining controversies in China. So this was one of the 8 great qualities of the ocean and many others. And then one of the qualities was that just as the great ocean does not tolerate a corpse, but when there's a corpse which dies in the ocean, it will wash it up and will reject it upon the shore, in the same way that the Sangha does not tolerate corrupt bhikkhus or corrupt bhikkhunis, but will expel them and kick them out. And so quite a strong statement there by the Buddha on the nature, on what he thought of corrupt people who are living the holy life but not pretending to live the holy life without really doing so sincerely. So after this point on, then the Sangha was authorized to perform its own uposatha, and perhaps it was at this point that the uposatha changed from being simply the recitation of a few communal verses to being like a formal declaration of the rules of training. And so at some point this change was made, and the custom on the Upasita came to be that the Sangha would come together, the Bhikkhu Sangha would come together as one, the Bhikkhuni Sangha would come together as one, and they would recite their rules of training which they had been laid down. That is what we know today as the Patimokkha. So of course this being in the Theravadin recension for the Bhikkhus, the 227 rules for Bhikkhus, the three nation. And also not just the Bhikkhus do their Upasita, also the Bhikkhunis. When there are Bhikkhunis visiting Wat Lanachat, then they also will, the abbot will do the questioning them for their Upasita and so on as well. So that's also done when there are visiting Bhikkhunis there. And so, you know, you really have that feeling of the fourfold assembly sort of participating in this kind of very, very ancient practice. And of course, just to add a little bit of spice to the mix, Ajahn Chah's own special ingredient was the all-night sit. And so once a week on the Upasita day or the small one prior, you would do sitting meditation all night. So that particular bit was not a regular part of the Upasita. Although you can see from that story I mentioned before with the Buddha sitting all night with the bhikkhus, that it probably did happen from time to time, but it's certainly not kind of mandatory as part of the way of keeping the Upasita day. But they, Ajahn Chah, wanted to do it, and so that's what they did. And one of the reasons, if you've lived in northeast Thailand, you'll know that it's during the daytime, it's stinking hot, and for much of the year, and extremely unpleasant. And so it's actually very nice to be staying up at night time, and it's a beautiful time to be staying awake and meditating. So the lay people, actually, it's quite the custom in those villages that the lay people will very often stay up all night, even just for parties or anything like that. They'll just have movies or singing or something like that, and that's the thing to do in the hot season, is to just stay up all night. And so no doubt that was kind of influencing this practice. So that's a very beautiful part of the lifestyle. And for us here at Santi Monastery, it's not so easy to keep the Upasita day so formally. Of course, our lives are much more dominated by the Western calendar and the weekends and things like that. I've kind of more or less followed along with Ajahn Brahm's done it in Bodhinyana, and there the Upasita is very minimal. And there's very little which is done really apart from the bhikkhus doing their Patimokkha together. And so apart from that, you wouldn't really even know that the Upasita was on. And that's what we've done here. It's kind of a shame. It would be kind of nice to do some more things to mark that. I believe in Amravati and the monasteries in England, they have a bit more of a compromise of doing some special practices on the Upasita day, which I think is, you know, quite probably a nice thing to do maybe when, as our monastery gets more established and more settled, we'll find the time to do those things as well. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the Upasita and some of the things that were done there both in ancient times and also today. So I offer this to you for your reflection.
Bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṁ